Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Welcome back, friend. Across 1968 and through 1969, there had already been three vicious and violent attacks on young couples in the San Francisco Bay Area. Four victims had lost their lives to a man known only as the Zodiac. This killer had gone from shooting his victims under the cover of darkness to stabbing them, ferociously up close and personal. A flip and modus operandi that startled and baffled the detectives hunting this man down. The Zodiac was skilled in finding young couples, alone, and in spots that were quiet and isolated. Their location nullifying, to an extent, the fact he went after two victims at the same time, a much riskier strategy than going after just one. He was an individual who appeared to enjoy taking such risks, yet planned and prepared to ensure he always remained in control. Across three crime scenes, Lake Herman Road, Blue Rock Springs, and Lake Berryessa, the Zodiac had attacked in acts of surprise and violence. Two victims had survived his brutality, but with his face always hidden, the identity of this man remained elusive and out of reach. The Zodiac Killer was a mystery that deepened with each new sickening attack. He was a dangerous and unpredictable human being who thrived on the chaos he created and wasn't finished yet.
In his violent movements, or rather the violent periods that he has been in, he's an absolutely ruthless, completely merciless killer. He calmly goes about his business of, he doesn't get great excitement over it. He thinks killing is just killing. So somebody like that is going to be a very serious problem for us.
On the evening of October the 11th, 1969, exactly 14 days after the attack at Lake Berryessa, three teenage siblings were settling down for the night at their home in San Francisco. They lived in Presidio Heights, a quiet, wealthy, and respectable neighborhood that wasn't usually the scene of violence and bloodshed. That night was a night like any other, until it took a drastic turn. At 9:55 p.m., a desperate 911 call came from that home. A teenager, scared and unsure what to do, reported a yellow 1968 Ford Galaxy cab parked at the intersection outside their home on the northeast corner of Washington and Cherry Streets. In the minutes before making the call, the three teens had watched from a top floor window, stunned as events played out in front of them. Around 60 feet away from their window, inside the cab, was a man slumped across the driver's seat. Leaning over him was another man who was positioned in the front passenger seat. He was older, his build was heavier, and his hair a lighter colour. Head bowed, he seemed to be searching through the first man's pockets. As they watched, the second man proceeded to wipe down the surfaces inside the cab with a white rag or handkerchief. He wiped over the driver's side and then the passenger side. He didn't seem in a rush or particularly agitated. Seemingly once satisfied, he got out of the cab, revealing his height to be around 5'8". He walked around the cab exterior, wiping down the outside of the doors and their door handles on both sides. He then backed away and began to walk north on Cherry Street, slowly disappearing from their view. His pace was gentle and steady. The man still inside the cab had not moved. His body was lying awkwardly across the passenger seat with his head angled down towards the footwell of the vehicle. The 911 call was logged at the dispatch centre at 9:58 p.m. San Francisco police officers Peter and Felicetti were the first to arrive. They were quickly followed by Inspector Craik, who took the lead of the scene. It's thought it was the inspector who opened the passenger door of the cab, enabling the man's body to be moved for his vital signs to be checked. Now lying on his back across the passenger seat, a large red stain was visible on the front of his shirt. In stark contrast to the sharp white shirt, the stain covered the majority of the man's chest, obscuring and blending in with the shirt's black vertical stripe pattern. An ambulance raced to the scene to try and administer any aid they could.
A call to the yellow cab company, with the identification number of the cab, confirmed the driver was 29-year-old Paul Stein. He was married and just months away from graduating with his PhD. He had spent years studying for his doctorate in English at the San Francisco State College. He wanted to be a professor. Paul Stein worked two jobs to pay for his studies and support his family. He sold insurance during the day and drove the cab at night, all striving towards completing his degree and moving into a higher-paying academic career. The medics did everything they could to save Paul, but his condition was too grave. He was pronounced dead at 10:10 p.m. that night. He had been killed by a single gunshot by his right ear. The gun was placed against his skin in the moment before the trigger was pulled. He didn't stand a chance against such a savage attack. His body remained in situ as a murder investigation was launched. Search teams, including 7 dog units, scrambled to the area and into surrounding streets, hunting for a suspect who is now a killer. The various officers arriving at the scene followed the description given by the dispatch center. They had described the suspect as a black adult male, 35 to 45 years old, around 5'8 to 5'10, with a heavy build and a reddish crew-cut hair. They said he was also wearing eyeglasses and wore dark-collared clothing. Leroy Sweet was the assistant traffic manager at the Yellow Cab Company. He told officers that Paul had started his shift at 8:45 p.m. that evening. He had picked up a fare near Agua Vista Park on the east side of the city and dropped them off at San Francisco International Airport, around 11 miles away. An hour later, at 9:45 p.m., Leroy had radioed Paul, sending him to 500 9th Avenue for a pickup. It was an address Paul Stein would never reach. At 10:46 p.m., as officers were still processing the scene, PETA and Felicetti noticed Paul's cab meter was still running. Its total was $6.25. Using this figure and tracking back through the various routes Paul could have driven, it was estimated Paul picked up his killer around 12 minutes before he was killed. The route from the airport to where he was found passes Union Square and Mason and Gary Streets. Both areas were ripe for picking up cab fares at night, in between phone-ins from dispatch. This area is 2.6 miles from where Paul's cab was found, a distance he would have covered in around 12 minutes. It's here that Paul Stein most likely picked up his final fare, a man who hailed his cab from the street, only to murder him in the minutes that followed. Paul's trip sheet for that night recorded the final fare going to Washington and Maple Streets. Yet Paul was found dead inside his cab one block over on Washington and Cherry. We will never know why that was the case, although there are several theories on why it may have happened. A set of bloody fingerprints were found on the cab, prints believed to belong to the individual who carried out the murder. As the years have gone by, no matches have ever been established. Paul's cab keys, his wallet, and cash have been stolen. At that time, officers believed Paul had been the victim of a robbery homicide. Sadly, an all too common event on the streets of San Francisco. In the days to come, however, the true extent of Paul's shocking death would come crashing in.
The search team stayed out for hours that October night, searching for the suspect the witnesses had seen inside Paul Stein's cab. Despite their efforts, nothing was found. There was one key factor that would come back to haunt the San Francisco Police Department with regard to the search that night. The witnesses reported the suspect as a white male, but dispatch made a mistake and issued the suspect details as a black male. The officers hunting the Zodiac through the streets that night didn't have the correct information. It's a mistake that most likely aided his escape into the night. The three teenage witnesses were asked to attend a formal interview to record their statements on file. They were asked to work with a composite sketch artist to try and produce a drawing of what the man looked like. This sketch remains today the only image of the Zodiac killer the authorities have to go on. A day after the sketch was released to the media, one of the teenagers asked to make some amendments to make it more accurate. A second sketch was made, and both sketches were sent out to the public to see if anyone could recognise the face looking back at them. 3 days after Paul Stein's murder, a letter was delivered to the San Francisco Chronicle, postmarked October the 13th, 1969. The handwritten envelope was posted from within San Francisco. Inside was a letter and an item that changed the course of the Paul Stein murder investigation.
This is the Zodiac speaking. I'm the murderer of the taxi driver over by Washington Street and Maple Street last night. To prove this, here's a blood-stained piece of his shirt. I'm the same man who did in the people in the North Bay area. The SF police could have caught me last night if they'd searched the park properly, instead of holding road races with their motorcycles seeing who could make the most noise. The car driver should have just parked their cars and sat there quietly waiting for me to come out of cover. School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out a school bus some morning. Just shoot out the front tire and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out.
San Francisco cab driver Paul Stein had been murdered by the Zodiac killer. Returning to his original MO of using a gun, the Zodiac had killed in a residential street overlooked by multiple houses. Again, he then took the stakes up a level higher by providing evidence of his work. A section of Paul Stein's shirt stained in blood accompanied the letter. After taunting the police for not finding him, he ended his letter with threats to the most vulnerable in our society. At Lake Berryessa, the Zodiac left the scribbled message on the door of Brian Hartnell's vehicle. Now he had mailed a piece of clothing his victim was wearing when he shot and ended his life. All his movements were thought out. This man was not afraid. He wanted to take risks and push the boundaries and then watch as no one was able to find him.
Bits and pieces of information, leads and tips from people who want to help catch the Zodiac killer have been pouring into police headquarters here at the Hall of Justice for the last few days. A new team of detectives has been added to the homicide detail in an effort to sift some of that information. Police are now convinced that it was the killer of a San Francisco cab driver who sent in a swatch of bloody cloth with a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle. Laboratory tests on the cloth torn from the shirt of Paul Stein, prove that it came, in fact, from the cab driver when he was murdered last Saturday night in Presidio Heights. And handwriting analysis of a foreboding letter indicates the writer is the same man who's committed 5 murders, 1 here, 3 in Vallejo, and 1 in Napa over the last 10 months. A composite drawing sketched in 4 hours from witnesses' descriptions has been widely publicized. People tend to forget, however, that it is not necessarily an accurate portrayal of the killer's likeness, just a translated remembrance of a brief look at his face. All of the letters sent by the killer have been posted from San Francisco, and police believe the man either works or lives in the city. His chilling allusions to future slayings are being countered with an intense drive to prevent him from fulfilling any promises. Dick Carlson reporting for Newsbeat from San Francisco Hall of Justice.
Each attack had been a step up from the last. Each letter was a leap further from the one before. It was more shocking, more complex, and more threatening. The Zodiac thrived on creating and maintaining fear. His need to shock seemingly required a new escalation in how and where he killed, each time he launched another attack. In San Francisco on that October night, the Zodiac committed a terrible crime that would be fitting with the backdrop of a city that sadly sees violent murders on its streets all too often. He waited until the initial 48 hours of investigation had passed before dropping his bombshell, before proudly announcing he was the killer and providing the evidence to prove it. This letter, however, wasn't only to take credit and gloat over Paul Stein's murder. It was to threaten young children as they traveled to and from school on their school bus. His language was flippant and teasing, creating the most extreme fear in parents and schools across the city. The Zodiac had now threatened their children. The citizens of San Francisco were horrified and terrified at such a foreboding threat. Protecting the city's children while intensifying the hunt for this violent killer was now the priority. The city held its breath, waiting for the Zodiac's next move.